Showtime. Welcome to the show. I'm Brent Holland, and welcome one and all to Night Fright. November 22nd, 1963, the John Kennedy assassination. Some say the world was changed forever. Not just America, but the world, folks, because John F. Kennedy perhaps may have been the first globalist. Now, when the motorcade came down Elm Street and those shots rang out and the president was mortally wounded, what was taking place several cars behind him? In the cars behind him, directly behind him was the Secret Service, but behind that was the Vice President waiting in the wings, as is stated in Oliver Stone's JFK. Now, is it possible that a coup d'etat had just taken place with Lyndon Johnson holding the reins and seizing the reins of power? That's what we're going to look at tonight in an explosive new book called LBJ, The Mastermind of the JFK Assassination. Our guest tonight, Philip F. Nelson. Don't go anywhere, folks. It's going to be a great show. Strap in and hang on. Here we go.
There is a time to question. There is a time for answers. There is a time to challenge. There is a time to speculate. There is a time for change. There is a time for truth. The time is now. Welcome to Night Fright, your voice in the dark for paranormal and conspiracy radio. And now your host, Brent Holland.
Welcome, one and all. Welcome to Night Fright. I'm Brent Holland, your host. Welcome. I want to start off right away. We're going to be looking at a very touchy subject tonight, one that is going to attack perhaps the fabric of democracy in America, and that is the possibility that on November 22nd, 1963, in Daley Plaza, the JFK assassination, a coup d'etat took place. And waiting in the wings, as is the thesis for JFK by Oliver Stone, was none other than the Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Our guest tonight, Philip Nelson, has a new book out called LBJ, The Mastermind of the JFK Assassination. I want to welcome you to the show right away. Thank you, Philip, for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you.
Can I call you Phil? Is that okay?
Yes, you may. Absolutely, certainly.
Thank you very much. Now, this is a thesis, you know, of course, as I mentioned before, Oliver Stone's movie basically says that. What type of proof is out there? I guess we should start off and just say a little bit about the possibilities that this could have taken place, this coup d'etat. LBJ was the vice president. He was waiting there to accept the reins of power. What type of proof are we looking at for this type of thesis?
Well, I think that there are a lot of proofs that are spread throughout the book. The book is something like 568 pages in the new edition, and there are 1,600 citations to other works, approximately 200 other books and other references, newspapers, news magazines, and so forth, have been made, and the narrative of this book simply connects one to the next to the next. And half of the book, the first half of the book, really is all about setting the context for these rather provocative charges. I understand it's a very sobering thought, an idea, that the coup d'etat could have been arranged within Johnson's own, within Kennedy's own cabinet, including the chief provocateur, I believe, Lyndon B. Johnson.
Phil, do you think that Johnson started off his vice presidency with the full intent of taking out JFK, committing this coup d'etat, and actually taking over the reins of power? Or do you think perhaps this was something that came about at the urging of other forces around him?
Well, I think there was a little of the latter. However, I believe that Johnson, as described in my book, it goes all the way back to his childhood. He had a dream that became an obsession. And this obsession was that he wanted to become the president of the United States at all costs, irrespective of what it meant to anyone else. And that all along the way, he was driven by a mania. He was plagued by a number of mental issues, shall we say, one of which was bipolar disorder, then known as manic depressive. And his mania is what drove him higher and higher up the political rung, the rungs of the ladder that took him to the vice presidency. And I believe that all along the way now, you have to understand, he spent 26 years in Congress, well, 23 years from 1937 to 1960. And the first of those years was in Congress, and he had to, he believed, set a course all along the way. And according to some people, some of his closest associates, including Cliff Carter, has said in his oral history that he believed that Johnson was planning to become president as early as 1937. Robert Caro has pretty much stated that in 1941, he even turned down a major stake in an oil company or in oil wells because he didn't want to be considered an oil man. Now, that wouldn't have hurt him in Texas, but he knew that eventually he would have to appeal to a much broader base. And that base would be a more national base, and it was at that point that he did not want to be known as an oil man. He decided to acquire his wealth in other ways, and in 1943, he and Lady Bird bought a little radio station down in Austin, and it was a distressed sale. And it was distressed basically because Johnson had been behind the FCC. He had many appointments already, and the FCC denied all the requests for a broader license to this radio station as long as it was held by the previous party. Well, that
can I just interrupt you there for a second?
Sure.
I just want to orientate folks. The FCC is the American version, of course, of the CRTC. That's all I wanted to say. Also, we're talking about Lyndon Baines Johnson, the vice president of the Kennedy administration. Was he waiting in the wings, all set to grab the reins of power once JFK was assassinated? Did he actually manipulate the assassination to his own benefit? And this is what we're examining tonight in a new book, and our guest tonight is Philip F. Nelson. The book is called LBJ, The Mastermind of the JFK Assassination. If you're just joining us, folks, we're just getting started. Easy way to get the book is always www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on the book cover. That'll take you right to a spot where you can order it from the comfort of your own armchair. Right online, you can order the book. And it is thoroughly, thoroughly researched. And it's a terrific read. He's an excellent writer, by the way. Philip, you're an excellent writer, without question.
Well, thank you.
Now, everybody knows that politics is an extremely dirty game, without question. We like to believe that democracy is in full swing and that it's very open and very transparent, but in a lot of cases, nothing is further from the truth. Are there templates where, prior to the assassination, LBJ was less than scrupulous, let's put it that way, less than straightforward? Was he indeed an instigator, perhaps swaying more towards the dirty end of politics?
Well, all along his that journey I mentioned that started back in the 30s, he had been become more and more involved in criminal activities, so that by the 1950s, he was deeply involved in a number of different criminal activities, including helping the mafia through Carlos Marcello and his lieutenants in Texas. There were a number back then. Savella was one, and Campisi was another. They both had their fingers in what was called the numbers racket. And a fellow named Jack Halfin, who was eventually prosecuted, who had worked for them, testified that eventually that Johnson had been paid off hundreds of thousands of dollars. In fact, it was close to $500,000 a year in the latter part, basically to buy his influence in Congress, to keep investigations away from them. And this is all documented and cited in the book. He also became involved in a number of murders, and this is according to his own associates, and his lover of 21 years, with whom he had a boy in 1950,
Madeline Brown,
and Billy Saul Estes later came forward and stated that Johnson was behind anywhere from 10 to 17 murders. He could only speak for himself for 10 of those. Five of whom were people who worked with Estes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, Philip. Can you just explain that relationship between Billy Saul Estes and LBJ? A lot of people aren't aware of that.
Okay. I'd be glad to. Billy Saul Estes had been known as a wheeler dealer in West Texas, and he had cornered the market on certain business arrangements, basically involved in the irrigation of West Texas and in the acquisition of this liquid fertilizer and dry ammonia, I think it's called. And he had connected himself through some major financial companies in order to set this up. And I'm trying to condense this all. It was a very complex scheme involving two major components, and one of those was the acquisition of cotton allotments. And back in those days, the Congress decided that cotton was they had such a surplus of cotton that they wanted to limit production. And the only way that you could apply new cotton allotments to all this land that Billy Saul Estes was trying to produce cotton on was to buy land that had been taken by the government through the process known as eminent domain. That is, they would condemn property to build interstate highways at that time. And during the 1950s, they were putting interstate highways throughout the South. And so a lot of farmers lost the land that they had previously used to grow cotton, and he arranged through some very manipulative processes to acquire that land and really move those allotments from the old land to his land. And in the process, the farmer was paid for the allotment, and then when the farmer there was an implicit understanding between them that the farmer would never really pay for the new land. Mm-hmm. Okay, that he would simply not pay for it, but in the meantime he had been paid for the cotton allotment. So the result was they would foreclose on the loan, and Billy would wind up with the cotton allotment applied to his land. And by the way he did this in some really strange ways. He would sell lots, that were about 40 feet wide and 2 miles long. Okay? There was no way that the farmer, that any of these farmers could ever exercise control over that land, and with the irrigation issues and the fertilizer and all that, that they were sort of cornered into this deal. So he acquired thousands of acres of land. He applied cotton allotments in this rather, backhanded way, and he also had fertilizer. Was selling fertilizer, and he had leased fertilizer tanks, thousands of fertilizer tanks that were really non-existent. And then there was the grain storage. There was also another grain storage fraud going on. There were three different major facets of this fraud.
Son of a gun. But how does Lyndon Johnson come to meet up with this fellow?
This fellow had decided back in the 50s that the best way to accomplish things would be to pay off politicians in Washington. So he decided on Lyndon as his main payoff guy. And the result was that it was documented in somewhere and referred to in the book that he eventually paid off Lyndon Johnson to the tune of about $10 million.
Now, was Lyndon fully cognizant of what was taking place here? Was he?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely he was, because he and 3 weeks after the Kennedy-Johnson team was sworn in, he was contacting the newly sworn Department of Agriculture Secretary, Orville Freeman, to rewrite the rules to better expedite all of this, to put the decision-making powers back in the local organizations instead of having it done in Washington. And by so doing, they knew that they could control the decisions, more consistently with their objectives. And they actually rewrote the rules, this is all documented, in order to facilitate the defrauding of their own government.
Folks, don't go anywhere. Like I said before, we're looking at the possibilities tonight that Vice President Lyndon Johnson was behind the JFK assassination and indeed orchestrated it all and was waiting virtually in the wings to take those reins of powers. We're looking at a new book called LBJ, The Mastermind of the JFK Assassination. The plot is starting to thicken, but One thing, folks, this is not a movie. This is real life, and this took place. Philip F. Nelson's our guest tonight. Easy way to get the book, as always, folks, www.nightfrightshow.com. Click on the book cover. That'll take you to a place online where you can order the book from the comfort of your own home. Masterfully written, and James Fetzer says the same thing, a masterpiece, beautifully written. Great writer, Philip. Now, how did he become the choice for the Kennedy administration to choose to be vice president? Was there others that perhaps was on the, that were on the list, and all of a sudden he came to be?
That is a very good question, because I want to go back to the year 1958 to preface all of this. And the reason I do is because Lyndon Johnson had some friends in the Texas legislature changed the law in Texas to allow him to run for the national ticket, as well as to rerun for his old seat in the Senate, because he didn't want to lose one at the risk of not winning the other. So he wanted to still maintain his power. So his planning, his specific planning to become vice president, started in 1958. Now, in the process, John Kennedy, Hubert Humphrey, others were running for the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party, and Lyndon Johnson committed himself not just to the Kennedys, but to some of his own staff, that he was not running for president, even though he had just had the law changed to allow him to do so. With the law actually allowed him to run for either president or vice president. the key here is that after having done all of this, he did not declare his presidential plans until July the 5th of 1960, 5 days before the start of the Democratic Convention. In other words, he missed out on all the primaries, all the politicking that went on. And here was JFK going around to all the different primaries. And back in those days, the primaries weren't exactly the same as they are today. There weren't as many of them. Most of the decisions, admittedly, were made in the back rooms, the smoke-filled corridors of state capitals and the national capital and so forth. But there were these primaries, and some of the most important of them were in Oregon, Wisconsin, Maryland, things New Hampshire and so forth, some smaller states, but also Illinois. It was a rather big state. And he didn't show up in any of these. And the only place he did show up was in West Virginia, and it wasn't to politic to try to corner delegates or to even run in the primary. He only went there to criticize Jack Kennedy and Joseph P. Kennedy, JFK's father.
So he was kind of at odds with Kennedy. So this is
he was a,
this makes yes. this whole narrative, the whole story, even more bizarre that he would end up as vice president, doesn't it?
It does, because as a result of all of this, and he was constantly needling and prodding Kennedy and provoking different things, and he wound up not being on the not only on the short list of possible vice presidential nominees. As far as JFK was concerned, he wasn't even on the long list. He wasn't on any list, but he got himself on the list through blackmail and threats.
Let's talk about that.
Okay. One of the blackmail things that happened was that there was a break-in in one of Kennedy's doctor's offices in New York. 2 or 3 weeks before the convention started, and that's where he learned for sure that JFK had Addison's disease, and he used that. In fact, he told John Connally, who had been his partner, you know, in a lot of different things for many years, and an assistant since the early 40s, that JFK suffered this disease. So on July the 4th of 1960, just the day before Lyndon announced his own candidacy, Connally was going around the convention. He was in Los Angeles, and he was going around telling people, the delegates out there, that the JFK had this disease that would kill him eventually, basically putting JFK on notice that, you know, this was a no holes barred deal, that he better make some time together to consider this. Well, the evening that JFK got the nomination for president, he won on the first round. Johnson had told people that he really thought he could win on the second round, you know, if he could get by the first round and so forth. Well, that was, I believe, all meaningless. He had no intention to run for president because he had been counseled by his friends, fellow Southerners, Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House, and Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, for years and years, that as a Southerner, he had zero chance to run for the presidency and actually win the nomination and then go on in the general election and win there. So
did he approach Kennedy, or did Kennedy approach him to be vice president?
He absolutely approached Kennedy. And through Sam Rayburn and some other people, including Phil Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, who he had a group of people who, you know, had decided that Lyndon was the guy that ought to be on the ticket as the vice president. So the first effort was through these friends who who separately contacted Kennedy. They didn't get anywhere. So Rayburn and or Johnson called John F. Kennedy shortly after he accepted the nomination and didn't request a meeting. They demanded a meeting that evening. They had to meet. Now, in the meantime, it's important to understand that JFK had already given the nod to Senator Stuart Symington of Missouri, because they knew that he was very popular for other reasons in California, and that they could take California if Symington was on the ticket. Johnson here was putting forth the story that he was really needed on the ticket in order to take Texas. Well, it could have gone either way. Had they had Symington, they wouldn't have needed Texas because they would have gotten California. As it was, they eventually lost California. Yes, they took Texas, but only because of 100,000 bogus votes. There was election fraud big time in Texas and in Illinois. And in nine other states, there were incidences of it. However, Nixon backed off at that point and asked that it not be pursued. He didn't want to create a constitutional crisis, according to him. According to Nixon, that is. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that Johnson definitely forced himself onto the ticket. He really gave the Kennedys no choice, because not only was there the blackmail attempt, the Addison disease, the womanizing, they knew all about that. In fact, LBJ's buddy, Bobby Baker, was the guy who set up a lot of the women who wound up being with JFK.
Okay, hang on to Bobby Baker. I'm just going to tell folks who we're speaking with, and we got to come right back to Bobby Baker. I said before, the plot thickens, and it really does, doesn't it? This is real life, folks. We're talking about the possibility that LBJ was the mastermind, as the book says, of the JFK assassination. Our guest tonight has written an explosive new book. His name is Philip F. Nelson, www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on the book cover associated with tonight's guest. Take it right to a place where you can order the book online. As you know, folks, Night Fright does a lot, probably more than any other show of this nature on the JFK assassination. It's something I hold dear to my heart. I'm very proud of that fact. The fact that we're bringing new information, new researchers forward all the time and bringing this information to light, because mainstream just runs away from this subject matter for whatever reason, close to 50 years later, and they're still running away from this information. So we're looking at that possibility now. Bobby Baker, back to you, Phil. Bear with us, folks, because this, you know, they're all little dots, and we're connecting them, and what is going to come through at the end is going to be pretty darn shocking, I will say. Can we explain how Bobby Baker works into this mix, if you will? As I go like this, I feel like the three witches at the beginning of Macbeth, because really this is what they were doing. They were stirring the pot of something most evil. Can we talk about Bob Baker?
What I like to do is just recap the three major scandals that Johnson had brought into the Kennedy administration with him. Okay, and during this period of 1961 to 1963, the first was really the TFX scandal, and that had to do with the production of a new jet fighter that would have been used by the Air Force and the Navy, and it later became called the F-111. It was basically had been decided to give that contract to the Boeing Corporation of Seattle, Washington. Well, that didn't work too well as far as Lyndon was concerned. And by the way, one of the things he demanded as he took the slot as the vice presidential nomination was to be given a lot of the power to make appointments. And so he appointed John Connally as, initially he had John Connally appointed as the Secretary of the Navy. That lasted a year before he decided to run for the governorship of Texas. So he replaced him with a guy named Fred Korth. Fred Korth had been the general counsel of the Continental National Bank of Fort Worth, and worked very closely with General Dynamics. General Dynamics was owned, well, the 20% interest was owned by a fellow up in Chicago. His name escapes me right now, but it was through this amalgamation of these different interests that they caused that contract award to be given to General Dynamics of Fort Worth rather than Boeing.
Uh-huh.
Johnson, it was later shown that Johnson was, and this is sworn testimony that was given on November the 22nd, ironically, that Johnson was given $100,000 to throw that contract. Okay, so that was one scandal. And then I just mentioned Billy Solestis, yeah, and the at least four murders of people connected to him that were all intended to keep Billy Solestis quiet, to keep his lips sealed. And they were sealed for many years, even after Johnson died. But then eventually they became unsealed, and he was the one who should be really given the most of the credit for the knowledge that now exists about those murders. I will say one thing. In the book, I've noted 10 of those murders of those four people plus others that only one man uniquely benefited from, and that was Lyndon B. Johnson. I know that this is very troubling news to a lot of people who haven't heard some of this before, but it's all true. Well, okay, so that brings us to Bobby Baker. Bobby Baker had been a page when he was a young lad, and I guess he was 14 or 15 when he first came to Washington from South Carolina. And so when he was 20, that's when Johnson had just been, he wasn't really elected to the Senate, mind you. He stole that election, too. I mean, that's all defined in the book, too. It's all described, and that involved the stealing of thousands of votes, not just those last 203. It was thousands of other votes. But it came down to the wire, and so he stole that election, was sent to Washington to become the senator instead of just a congressman. Now, and it was at that point that he first met Bobby Baker. Bobby Baker was in his 20s still. But he worked there, and Johnson called him into his office one day and wanted to know where all the skeletons were buried. And, you know, and that was the formation of a partnership that grew and grew during the 1950s and the early 60s. And they just had a lot of different things going on where it all involved the peddling of influence, though. And there were people connected to the mob, the mafia, that Bobby Baker was dealing with throughout this time. And they had a number of scams going on that resulted in, you know, millions of dollars being given to Johnson through Bobby Baker, through some of the others, through his other assistants, and including his lawyer, a fellow by the name of Ed Clark, down in Austin, Texas. The group of them, and it was something that only Johnson could have put together and made this cohesive group that were involved in a number of crimes and the selling of political influence.
Phil, you had mentioned the mob, and we all know that Bobby was going after the mob enthusiastically, would be to put it mildly. Did he ever try to influence Bobby and say, back off?
You mean Lyndon and Bobby?
Yeah. Because they were always at loggerheads, right? Always at loggerheads, those two. And I was just curious if that was one of the issues surrounding that whole confrontation between the two of them, because Lyndon may have been tied in with mob money, perhaps, or mob influence, that perhaps he wanted Bobby to back off a little bit.
Well, I know that they there are many, many references in the book about this battle between those two, and it That started way back in the early 1950s, and it increased and ratcheted up through the years until they just hated each other. But I don't know as to whether Bobby ever confronted or whether he ever confronted Bobby on this. I don't know, but there are many instances where we know that Bobby was out to get Lyndon. And basically, it all started back in that 1960 decision. But Bobby was the one who was really upset that JFK had acceded to Johnson's blackmail and threats. They stayed up that whole night trying to figure out how could they get him back off the ticket. They offered him to other positions. They definitely wanted him out of the Senate, but. But Bobby really didn't want him as the vice president, and neither did JFK. Yet they had no choice. They were connived into offering Johnson this on the basis that, well, Johnson just wants it, you know, because he wants the deference. He thinks that they should come to him and offer it to him, but he got the word out that even though they really needed to do that, he wouldn't really accept it. Well, he did accept it, and he stuck to it, and he wouldn't release it. He wouldn't let it go, and he, in that way, with all these maneuverings, forced himself onto the ticket again. As soon as that happened, and as soon as they took power, Johnson began not as a team player. I'm talking about the earliest days of the administration. I mentioned before how Johnson went to Orville Freeman to have the rules for the Department of Agriculture rewritten to allow this fraud to go on.
That's right.
Well, he did a lot of other things that were completely inconsistent with the role of a vice president, which should be and always was and all has been since then. You know, the vice president is a supporter, a loyal supporter, of the president, and. He was he would be an assistant, so to speak. Well, Johnson was anything but that. He fought Kennedy behind the scenes on foreign initiatives and domestic policy. He sided with the military chiefs, for example, in Berlin, in Cuba, in South Vietnam, and Laos. All of that, he sided not with the president, but with the military chiefs and the intelligence.
In the book, part of your thesis is, by the way, folks, we're talking about the possibility that the book is called LBJ, The Mastermind of the JFK Assassination. Our guest tonight is Philip F. Nelson, www.nightfrightshow.com. Please click on the book cover. It is a good read. It's very, very, very well written. I have to admire your writing prose. Very, very well written. Part of the thesis is the assassination took place in order for an attack to go back into Cuba. Did Johnson halt that afterwards? Was Johnson involved in holding back the armed forces and going into Cuba? Or was that just, how do you feel about that scenario?
Well, I think that's a very interesting scenario because a lot of that was set up by the, I believe, the CIA. Now, I'm not saying the CIA as an organization, but some renegades within the CIA were definitely involved, and that's the subject of other books, which stop there. By the way, they don't go to the Johnson link.
It's a good. It was a segue to talk about Operation Mongoose.
Well, yeah, there were. A number of operations in connection with that, but I believe that the people in the CIA, knowing that if Kennedy was not taken out and was reelected, that would be the end of their careers because he had already threatened to tear the CIA up into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. And that was a famous quote that he had stated. He had already planned to revise the whole intelligence apparatus to get it back to conform more with what Harry S. Truman had meant when had intended to do when he set it up in the first place. It had gotten way out of control, and all through the 1950s, Alan Dulles, being the head of it, actually grew the CIA in every conceivable way possible, and the number of employees and their reach into other cultures, other countries around the world, and they fostered insurrections, not just in this hemisphere, but in other places like Iran. They were involved in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba of the Congo.
That's right.
And so forth. All of these things were going on way beyond the scope of what they were supposed to be doing, and that was gathering intelligence.
Yeah, essentially the CIA wasn't following policy or being dictated to them by the administration. They were making up their own things and doing things right behind Kennedy's back. Kennedy would tell them, geez, you know, stop all the clandestine operations towards Cuba, and they were doing them anyways. Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they were, well, they were out to actually murder Castro, and there were several attempts where they brought in the mafia to help deliver some poison pills down there and some other attempts on Castro's life. Well, they never got it done, obviously. He's still alive.
Do you think Johnson was cognizant? Did he know about these operations going on behind his back?
I think that there's very little that Johnson did not know about it, because Johnson had contacts within every, he had unique contacts into every department or every other interest group, let's say. The CIA, the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover was his best friend and neighbor for 20 years. That they lived across the street from each other. I drove down that street a couple of times, and here's Johnson's old house, and here's Hoover's, one house up and right across the street. They used to walk their dogs together and talk over the, you know, they met each other often. J. Edgar Hoover has, at that time, was considered some sort of a hero in the United States, and it wasn't until after his death also that the truth became available about him and about, you know, what a demagogue he was and some very strange dealings, including the testimony of certain ex-FBI agents who stated that they were involved in some of these black bag operations, like as would have happened in that incident where they broke into Kennedy's doctor's offices to discover the secrets of his illnesses.
When did Lyndon put the plot afoot, if you will? Was the plot already underway when Lyndon jumped in halfway through, a quarter of the way through, or did Lyndon actually start this thing right from the beginning?
Well, you know, others argue that When Nixon lost the presidency to Kennedy and Johnson, in 1960, that upset a lot of people over in Langley and in the Pentagon and so forth, and it's true, it did. And they probably started their own little plotting about the same time. However, my point is, Johnson started in 1958 to get himself onto the ticket, and then let events evolve, unfold, however you want to put it, in conjunction with these people. His top military aide was a guy by the name of Colonel Howard Burris, and he had contacts, direct contacts, not just to the Pentagon, but to the CIA as well. Now Johnson had developed his own contacts there and with Dulles himself, with other people from the what was called the Eastern Establishment, Nelson Rockefeller, for example, and John McCloy. John McCloy would later be named to the Warren Commission along with Alan Dulles, both arguably conspirators before the fact, and in order to ensure that the case never really got solved, and to keep the commissioners off track enough. In other words, it was decreed as within minutes, at least hours, after JFK's murder, that Oswald was the assassin. And there's proof of that in the book that that states that that information was transmitted to the three Air Force, or the three Boeing 707s that were in the air on the way to Washington. That included the third one that had been out in Hawaii with six of the 10 cabinet members on there, and it had been rerouted back to Washington. And it was announced on that airplane that they had caught the assassin. His name was Oswald, and he had been a communist defector, former Marine, the whole deal. It was that early in the evolution of this story.
Now, Johnson, what was his motivation for seizing power? Did he want it? Was it the Vietnam War, essentially?
No. Johnson, as I said earlier, had an obsession to become president, and he believed it was his destiny.
I see.
He believed it was cut in stone. It was going to happen one way or the other.
And he was going to make that manifest some way.
This was from the time he was 12 years old. Now, against the advice of his senior mentors there in Congress, Sam Rayburn and Richard Russell, I mean, who told him he had no shot at becoming president, he decided to devise another way to achieve that high office. And that was when he started this plotting in 1958 to get himself on the ticket, not as the presidential candidate, but as the vice presidential candidate. Okay, because then, even if they lost to Nixon in the general election, that wouldn't have put him out of the picture. He could have rerun in 1964 if he could get his fragile ego to the point where he thought he could withstand a loss. But he didn't want to take that risk in 1960. Yet he wanted to be on the ticket. See, so
any chance. The cover-up, obviously, was a conspiracy cover-up. Any chance the cover-up took place, part of the thesis, not a thesis, but part of the story in the movie JFK is that there was a fear of a third world war starting because a year beforehand, of course, was a Cuban Missile Crisis. Any chance that it could have been as simple as that, as naive as that, and not as... Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry. That was a plan B. Okay, if in the event that it would be conclusively shown that it was a conspiracy, then they had that to fall back on. But that would have involved going to, at least an invasion of Cuba, and it would run the risk of a war with the USSR, the Soviet Union, since become known more generally as Russia. And if that were the case, then the thought of a nuclear showdown with the Soviet Union, with Cuba in the middle of it, would have, and the missiles, which had already been put in Cuba, and many thought they were still there in November of 1963, would have run the risk of those missiles being directed right to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Well, Johnson didn't want any part of that. You see, I believe that he had all along in mind that he wanted the lone nut scenario to play out against the wishes of those in the military, like Curtis LeMay and this ex-general Charles Willoughby and others, and the people in the intelligence community, Alan Dulles and Helms and Angleton and all of those. They would have liked to have seen an invasion of Cuba. But Johnson didn't want that. In fact, it's noteworthy that he turned his back to anything to do with Cuba, not just an aggressive military confrontation, but any kind of a peaceful coexistence whatsoever. He wanted nothing to do with that. He wanted his own little war, but he wanted his war on the other side of the world.
So, you know, and there's that chilling quote that's in your book and also in the movie JFK where Johnson says very, very matter-of-factly, and it just sends goosebumps up and down my spine, "Get me elected, I'll give you your damn war." And that's a direct quote. That's a true quote. And that's scary as hell.
That was a quote at a Christmas party within a month after he became president, you know, through the back door. He had the Joint Chiefs there, and that is exactly what he told them. He needed to be reelected, or no, he needed to be elected on his own right in 1964, and then you can have your war. Well, he was heavily invested in General Dynamics and in Bell Helicopter and some other defense industries. And guess who benefited the most from that?
Yeah.
You know, in 1962, General Dynamics was nearly bankrupt. And they were given that contract for that TFX, then to be known as F-111. And so there were thousands of those airplanes built. And everybody knows about the Hueys and all the helicopters that were in Vietnam. And, well, these companies made millions and millions of dollars. Henry Crown was the financier from Chicago that I referred to earlier that I was drawing a blank on. He was 20% owner of General Dynamics. His son, Lester, who is now about 85 years old, I read, and it's in, there's a footnote in the book about this, in the economic crash of 2008-2009, he lost a good part, 20% of his fortune, $1 billion. So now he's only worth $4 billion.
Phil,
like I said,
I know, Phil, there's a couple, we're running out of time very quickly. There's a few points I just want to ask you, and one of them is, Johnson did not run for the 1968 election. He decided he wasn't going to run. Initially, was his plan to run and try and get two terms?
Yes.
Okay, was Bobby running a surprise to him?
Well, Bobby and he, you know, all this time, as soon as the assassination happened, by the way, of course, Bobby was cut off from the top by Lyndon and from the bottom by J. Edgar Hoover. So he remained as an attorney general in name only. And all the while, I believe that Bobby knew exactly what was going on. And He said some words to the effect that if people knew what I know about Dallas, there would be blood in the streets.
Yeah.
Bobby Kennedy, and in fact, it's very ironic that J. Edgar Hoover said almost the same words to someone, a son of one of these oil millionaires. I don't have the words in front of me, but it was very similar to that. And in other words, it would be a very catastrophic for the country if I told you what I really know. Well, so here we have two people who also hated each other, probably more even passionately than Bobby and Lyndon hated each other. I mean,
Do you think Lyndon may have been involved in the Bobby assassination? Bobby Kennedy, folks, by the way, we're talking about Bobby.
Well,
speculation.
I believe so. I haven't studied that in as much detail, and I would like to do that at some point, but it's hard to not come to that conclusion, isn't it? You know, once you've read what I've already written in this book, and there are others. This is not the first time, by the way, that anyone has written a book which accuses Lyndon Johnson of being behind it.
But I think it's the most thoroughly researched book, and for sure the best written book, without question.
Well, thank you for that. I believe that it is the most all-encompassing in terms of looking at the entire assassination from the earliest days all the way through. And I believe what it shows is that there was a continuum. It wasn't a pre-assassination and a post-assassination conspiracy. It was a single continuum of a conspiracy that morphed on the November the 22nd of 1963 into an extension of the previous.
Phil, if Americans November 22nd, 1963, we keep coming back to that date, folks, if Americans lost their country that day to a coup d'etat, have Americans got their country back? in 2011?
Well, now that's a very interesting question. I think a lot of people would say no, that we're still being controlled by some of the same elements, that we still have the CIA. The CIA is still doing some very troubling things around the world. It's still, I think it was reined in during the 70s to a considerable extent, and it's not nearly as out of control as it had been in the 50s and 60s. But there are still things that jeopardize, I think, the national security, ironically. And it was the national security that everyone said, in the days after the assassination, it was the canard that was put out there to say that, well, all of this is under wraps. We really can't talk about it. And this evidence is something that's so secure that we have to put it away for 75 years, even though it was just a lone nut, some kind of a loony commie did all this. We have to keep all of this under seal for 75 years. Well, that didn't last too long, so that by 1992 or 93, the Congress voted for the JFK Assassination Records Act and so forth, and that created the Assassination Records Review Board, and it was designed to release all these millions of files. Well, we're still waiting. There are many, many millions of files that have still not been released, and probably a lot of them have already been destroyed. Well, we know much of the evidence was destroyed or fabricated or lost, like JFK's brain. What happened to that? The autopsy photographs. It's all been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that these records have really been either destroyed or fabricated in many, many ways. The crime scene, the limousine. What happened to that? Within 4 days, it was cleaned up within an hour.
Yeah, Johnson ordered that.
Yeah, all of this was done so that the crime scene would simply disappear, and the car was eventually rebuilt. You couldn't even recognize it based upon what it used to look like. It's in the Henry Ford Museum, but it's not even the same car.
It's
completely rebuilt.
We've got to wrap up now, Phil, but I want to thank you for coming on the show. Folks, www.nightfrightshow.com. The book is called LBJ, The Mastermind of the JFK Assassination. Philip F. Nelson is the author. He's been our guest tonight. www.nightfrightshow.com. Click on the book cover, folks, and give this a read. You're going to learn stuff about LBJ you didn't know before. Very, very well written. You're probably looking at the book and going, oh my God, 500 pages. It's like butter. Trust me. When you have a good writer, folks, it makes all the difference in the world. And Philip Nelson is a good writer. I want to thank you all for joining us. Thank you, Phil, for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you very much.
Much appreciated. And your time and your patriotism to do the work and research this subject for us. I'm Brent Holland. Thank you. I'm Brent Holland from Night Fright. See you next time.
You're listening to Night Fright and your host, Brent Holland. The time is now. Your voice in the dark for paranormal and conspiracy radio.